Borghoff.
Was he a listed fellow at the University of Cambridge, but who would move to Jekaterinburg. So some of you may have noted that, notably absent from the program of this conference, is any problem in Russia. But Anton might remedy that a bit, because Anton will only speak a year, speak on the perspective from domestic courts, specifically the domestic courts of Russia in relation to the European Court of Human Rights. Anton, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you, those who came to this audience today, whom I invited. Thank you for correcting the university. Yes, I moved back to Kaltenburg and I'm practicing human rights law with the NGO. You see the small flag as a background. And I'm teaching human rights law at the private university in New Kaltenburg, University of Humanities. And I will be speaking today based on the experience I received as a human rights lawyer and the experience of my colleagues all over the Russia. And I'll speak about how do we engage a Russian court, Russian judges, into the dialogue with the European Court of Human Rights. A little bit of a background. In 1998, May 5, Russia ratified the European Convention, and I think at this moment, the State Duma and also majority of the judges, a majority of the lawyers, litigators, trial lawyers, they hardly mentioned, noticed Article 1 of the European Convention. Everybody were, I think, looking at the Convention starting from Article 2, right to life, and so on. But Article 1 is the most important article which obliged the high contracting party to apply all these guarantees of the European Convention within the national legal system. That's an obligation as the same as to save, not to kill anybody, not to torture. So I think understanding of the European Convention was that, okay, we're ratified because that's a requirement to be a member of the Council of Europe. And then we will put it on the shelf, as we put all these other international human rights treaties on the shelf, UN treaties. But that was not the case. And this is the picture, this is the current apple pie from the European Court of Human Rights, a number of applications going to the European Court. And this red one is the Russian contribution to the backlog of cases before the European Court. It's actually much smaller, maybe twice as small as it used to be 2 years ago. But still, a lot of the biggest number of applications going. Of course, if we divide it per capita, Russia is not the leading country, but still, I think it's a scary number. And I think it happens because the human rights guarantees are not being taken into account by national courts. As you can see here, the numbers below, it's Russia is, as of last year, is a leading country against which the European Court delivered most of the judgments. And I think this is because of the attitude of judges, and then I later on will say that's also an attitude of regular lawyers who appear before those judges. This is a quotation from the interview. Online interview conducted by the Chief Justice of the Regional Court, one of the 80-plus courts in Russia, mostly appeal court and sometimes a court of the first instance. We were able to put the question to the judge whether they consider, whether the judges of this court actually know, study European Convention, whether there are any trainings, and this is the answer that we received. No, we do not conduct any trainings. We don't actually need it. All you need to apply Article 6, for example, of the Convention of Right to Fair Trial, all you need to know is the Russian Civil Procedure Code, for example. That was a very strange answer, because, especially from this court, especially from this judge, because a year before, in 2003, this court was the reason why the European Court of Human Rights issued one of the first judgments against Russia, Rakevich versus Russia. This is a case about incarceration in the mental hospital for 39 days. Not just incarceration, but treating with very heavy medical products without a court decision. And this court authorized, that basically ruled on an appeal, on a cassation back then, that it was all right in accordance with the Russian law. It's, another thing is interesting, that this conference was called Judges Shall Know Everything, except the convention. But the things are not as bad as this quote might imply. In 1993, Russia promulgated a new constitution, and this constitution basically said that all international treaties ratified by Russia are the part of the Russian legal system. And then part two of the constitution, which is on exclusively on human rights, was actually written based on the European Convention. And that's the drafters of the Russian Constitution told us that they were writing the draft of the Constitution based on the European Convention. Later on, the ECH, the Constitutional Court interpreting this Article 15, I didn't mention it, Article 15 of the Russian Constitution, which says that the treaties are part of the Russian legal system, interpreted even further, saying that not only the European Convention is part of the Russian legal system, but the case law of the European Court of Human Rights is the part of the Russian legal system. It's a source of law. And it was not only in the judgment, it was in a number of articles published by the Chief Justice of the Constitutional Court. This is a great development, and also the Supreme Court, it went even a little bit even further when giving issuing regulations by the plenum of the Supreme Court. This is a special sort of normative act. It's not a judgment by the Supreme Court. This is an explanation on how to apply legislation, and this regulation directed to the lower judges. So the Supreme Court so far issued two regulations in 2003 and 2013, which were devoted, mostly devoted, to the application of international law and particularly of the European Court, European Convention on Human Rights. And in one of those regulations, the last one in 2013, the Supreme Court said that not only the cases against Russia are legally binding for Russian courts, but also cases against other countries. It's interesting that this is an example of the dialogue, because at least I'm aware that when the Supreme Court was drafting these two regulations, the Council of Europe was involved in this process. There were consultants working on this, and particularly during the drafting of the last one, Justice Kohler from the European Court, who just recently retired in 2013 from this court, was involved in helping out to draft this regulation. So there is a dialogue on this top level in drafting constitution, in drafting this judgments of the by the Constitutional Court, Supreme Court. But when we look at how the same court, I don't have much time, I refer just to the Supreme Court of Russia, how the Supreme Court actually follows its own regulations directed to lower judges and to themselves. I looked at the two time frames from the date of ratification until 2003. This is the date of the first regulation, and after this. And basically, during the first period, there were no little examples, only 12 examples, where the Supreme Court referred to the European Convention. And there was no examples when it referred to the case law of the European Court of Human Rights. After 2003, the situation a little bit improved. Maybe a little bit more examples when the Supreme Court referred to the convention, but only 6 examples when the court referred to the case law. And for international lawyer to apply the European Convention, it means to look at the case law of the European Court. If you don't do this, you don't apply it correctly. And there are a number of examples, as the previous speaker mentioned, there were many mistakes in applying the European Convention. Yes, and I wanted to mention that somebody might wonder that are those 3,000 and other 3,000 cases are all human rights cases? I would say I would say no, but taking into account of the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, it considers cases as a first instance court, and I can say it's more like a constitutional court, which considers constitutionality of acts of the federal government and some of the ministries, all of the ministries of the Russian government, and so acts by the president. So it acts as a constitutional court. It doesn't consider only federal laws, federal statutes. So the majority of those judgments delivered, which I looked at, they were actually on human rights. Imply that one can refer to the European Convention if there is a need. The district courts, surprisingly, but the district courts of Russia might produce a better examples on application of the European Convention and the case law of the European Court. But that's not the because the courts are better, the judges are more aware of the European Convention. It's because of the lawyers which appear before those judges. Since 1998, a number of Russian non-governmental organizations organized a strategic litigation campaign where in all of the cases where it's possible, they argue the cases based not only on the Russian law, but on the European Convention and the case law of the European Court. And it's not just, let's refer to the European Convention, just to make it more beautiful. It's not. It's a thing which is very much required, because as a civil law country, judges are not accustomed to look at the case law, neither national or international. They look at just on the text of the statutes. And the text of the statutes can be interpreted this way or another. So this is why Russian human rights lawyers really took this tool of the case law of the European Court of Human Rights to narrow the way judges can interpret the Russian law. Basically, Russian law is more or less fine. It's the way it is interpreted and applied. And what we noticed is that the more you appear before the same judge, the more likely afterwards, maybe not right away, but this judge will actually open the convention and open the case law of the European Court, and your opponent, the defendant, will also be forced to look at the convention. And as I mentioned, the NGO lawyers are more successful than private attorneys. And here's the attitudes. We conducted interviews with some of the lawyers, some of the judges, not, of course, everybody in Russia, it's just impossible, but a big majority of the judges in Yekaterinburg city. And we asked judges and private attorneys whether they apply the European Convention and the case law. And the judges say, we would love to do this, but nobody asked us to do this. Why should I bother? And they're actually very busy. They overwhelmed with the cases. I recently came from Washington, D.C. I had a conversation with an appeal judge. He said, I'm very busy. I'm writing opinions. I said, how many opinions do you have to write each month? He said, 3. And smiled because he knows how Russian judges are overwhelmed with cases. So that's just like this. And all the judges, in some district courts, judges consider criminal cases, civil cases, administrative cases. They have to know everything. And the European Convention. Of course they don't want to do this. They want to go home after 6 o'clock. But if a lawyer appears and refers to the European Convention, the case law, they do this. And sometimes they ignore you, but the water... okay, sorry. So the private attorneys, they say, well, we would love to prepare a memorandum, we would love to prepare our case based on the European Convention. Well, why should I bother and spend my time, which is not, nobody pays me for this time, if the judge will just ignore my arguments? And this is true. This is often happens in our practice. We refer to the convention at one case, even before the Supreme Court and the Constitutional Court. The only argument is based on the European Convention in a particular case. And when we get the judgment, we read it, and there is no reference to the European Convention, as if we were not there. We were completely ignored. So, the legal strategy that NGOs used and are using right now, basically arguing, I would say there are two major reasons why Russian judges do not refer to the European Convention. First of all, they're busy. They don't want to bother with this big amount of case law of the European Court. And the second rule is basically there's the court, the judge, doesn't want to refer to the European Convention. Doesn't want to, we had one case where a widow of a person who died in a small cell wanted to appeal to challenge the non-federal government regulation which established just 2 square meters per person for a prison. It's a national standard, which is 5 meters less square meters than the European standard. So we wanted to challenge this regulation, and the widow was an applicant for the obvious reason, because the person had died in this small cell. The Supreme Court, and we knew that the Supreme Court might not accept this case, and we referred to the case law of the European Court in Article 2, where we said that the indirect victims cannot appeal to the court, can challenge the acts of the government. And the Supreme Court, we put a special paragraph in our application. It was completely ignored. So this is the second problem. And so the strategy was developed in order to deal with both major reasons for non-application. First, every time we go to the court, we refer to the European Convention. As I said before, there is a reason for this, to narrow down the way judges interpret the Russian law. And when we fail before national courts, we go to the European Court, but not only to prove that there was a violation of the right to freedom from torture, for example, freedom from inhuman treatment, like in this case that I just mentioned about the square meters in the cell. But also, we say to the European Court that, yes, there was this violation, but also there is a violation of the Article 6 of the European Convention, right to a fair trial, because we went to the court, the only argument we had, the most important argument we had, was ignored. This is not a fair trial. So that's what we're trying to do. This is some of the examples of the cases we are trying. So far, we didn't succeed before the European Court of Human Rights. We analyzed the case law of the European Court, which sometimes delivers judgments if major argument of a party was ignored. This can be a violation of Article 6. We want to advance this opinion by the European Court to say that if a national judge ignores arguments which were based on the European Convention, this is in itself a violation of Article 6. as I mentioned, Article 1 is the most important article in the European Convention. And again, as the, with the example of the Supreme Court of Russia, or Constitutional Court, there is a level of sort of dialogue trying to show that they work with the European Court, they take into account the opinion of the judges of the European Court, but on the ground, nothing or not much happens. I'll see the judge of the European Court just entered the room. I'm sorry. So we want to be able to have this opinion by the European Court of Human Rights. That's the ignorance of the arguments based on the European case law, European Court of Human Rights case law, is in itself a violation of Article 6. And back when we will have this judgment, we will be able to use it back in Russia to force or to ask the Russian judges to apply the European Convention directly. Thank you very much.
Drawing our attention to the very important role of the Council, indeed, as one of the factors that Mark have explained the way the courts address this phenomenon. Okay, well, we started a bit late, so we have some time for questions and comments. Professor Schreier. Yes,
thank you very much. Investment tribunals were only mentioned very briefly. In fact, investment tribunals constantly refer to decisions of earlier tribunals, and they've done so for a long period of time. They don't always agree. Sometimes they discuss other decisions and disagree with them, but most often they follow them. And sometimes there's even a theoretical discussion of the role of precedent and of uniformity. There's one particular doctrine that I ascribe to Gabriel Kaufmann-Kohler, who's actually developed a formula about precedents and how important they are, and that one should follow them. The highest authority in investment arbitration is, of course, enjoyed by the International Court of Justice. If you have a relevant precedent of the International Court of Justice as counsel for one side, you really feel good and you feel that you have the upper hand. This includes decisions of the PCIJ, of course. As to the European Court of Human Rights, their decisions are also quoted sometimes, incidentally, even in cases not involving parties to the European Convention on Human Rights. I remember one particular case against Bangladesh, which concerned an expropriation, and in that case, the European Court of Human Rights was quoted for two purposes. The first question was, is a judicial decision a protected asset? Answer, yes. And is there such a thing as expropriation through an act of a domestic court? Again, answer, yes. A final remark, and this actually ties in with what you just said, the role of counsel in the quotation of earlier decision is particularly important in arbitration for the simple reason that arbitration is very much party-driven, and in fact the typical commercial arbitrator would be very reluctant to rely on any type of authority that has not been adduced by the parties. I've been on tribunals where I said this is a wonderful, appropriate case, and my co-arbitrator